coming up in this episode. You know, he's, again, this very bored rich man of the Great Gatsby era with a top hat and cigar.
I think eccentric millionaires tap into a part of us that yearn to be able to take big risks without consequences.
Everything watered by Coca-Cola, apparently.
It's our holy water. May God bless you. This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Orlando Montoya.
And I'm Peter Biello. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind the stories mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. All right, Orlando, tell me what you've been reading lately.
Well, for this selection, I went into the biography section, and I picked out a biography of a very rich man with a famous last name in Georgia, but this is not an ordinary rich man's story. It is a strange story. It's right there in the title of the book. It's called Fortune and Folly, The Weird and Wonderful Life of an Eccentric Millionaire by Sarah Butler, and it's all about Asa Candler Jr., also known as Buddy.
Candler, okay, of the Coca-Cola Candlers.
This is the son of the Coca-Cola founder,
okay,
Asa Candler. So this is his son and namesake. And Asa Candler, the father, his is an all-American story, a farm boy with a firm work ethic, strong religious beliefs, a savvy businessman. He's a marketing mastermind, and he makes millions and millions of dollars. The son, however, Buddy, this is an American story too, but it's sort of the story of what happens when you inherit wealth. What happens when you can do whatever you want? It's all about pomposity, narcissism, conspicuous consumption, but it's also where some great Atlanta institutions began.
Oh, interesting. I have questions about parenting when it comes to inheritances like that, but I digress. I want to ask about the institutions. What institutions were you talking about?
Well, in this book, we're going to get the origin stories of Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, Emory University, Fox Theater, Zoo Atlanta, Westview Cemetery, and the Claremont Hotel, if I can remember those all. And, oh, by the way, in this book, we also get cameo appearances and side stories about Harry Houdini, booze running from Haiti during Prohibition, the Atlanta Crackers baseball team, and a murder-suicide at Buddy's estate.
That's cool. So for those who aren't from Atlanta, Orlando just named a lot of Atlanta things. If you're curious, just go to the Atlanta Wikipedia page. I guess they'll all be there, the zoo, et cetera.
He is the Atlanta thing.
Everything watered by Coca-Cola, apparently.
It's our holy water. May God bless you.
Well, where do you even start with all this? Maybe is there a timeline? You mentioned Prohibition. So are we talking about the 1920s and 1930s?
Yeah, the 1920s and 1930s is sort of Buddy's high life. But the book goes back to his childhood. He was born in 1880. He was schooled at Emory when Emory wasn't located in Atlanta. It was located in Oxford, Georgia, east of Atlanta. And it follows his marriage, his growing family, his young professional business life. And so by the time we get to the 1910s, he's 30 years old. And there's some clear indications at this time of his life that Buddy is not going to be like his father. He is not going to be a typical businessman. He's not going to have typical interests and pursuits. And Sarah Butler just calls him at this point weird.
I like to tell my kids that weird changes the world, that anything that ever changed the world started out weird, big, audacious. And Buddy did that. He came up with ideas that on the surface were just weird, right? When he came up with the idea for the Speedway, people weren't driving cars around here. Everybody thought that was a flash in the pan fad. Everything he did, airplanes, he brought airplanes in when they were just a spectacle. Weird changes the world. He thought about big, weird ideas, audacious ideas. And I think what we should learn from that is entertain those ideas because sometimes big things come from them.
So talking about the Atlanta Motor Speedway there.
Not the Atlanta Motor Speedway. Oh. She's actually talking about Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, which started as a speedway. Okay, so what's now ATL, the world's busiest airport, that land was sold to the city to use as an airport after it was Buddy's failed motor speedway venture. Now, a word you're going to hear me using a lot is failed. Buddy had a lot of failures, but he had a lot of successes too. And he was fascinated with new technology, whether it be cars, whether it be airplanes. He had a bunch of big cars, you know, rich man, got to have big cars.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let me ask you too, because he had a lot of failures, he had a lot of successes, but he also had the leeway to try, right? I mean, a guy with weird ideas is just a guy with weird ideas until you give him money.
That's right? That's exactly what Sarah Butler says.
I think eccentric millionaires tap into a part of us that yearn to be able to take big risks without consequences. We look at people who are eccentric and have the money to be able to do wild things, and there's a little bit of this living vicariously through it. I think it's one of the reasons for the, you know, popularity of flex culture in social media, for, you know, MTV Cribs. Even Willy Wonka is sort of a story of somebody eccentric doing something wild with money that none of us would ever be able to do, and I think that's attractive.
And so he's Willy Wonka of bygone era.
He's the Willy Wonka of Atlanta. He was a strange, eccentric millionaire. And there's so many stories. Like you said, where do we start? I mean, why don't we start with the cars?
Okay.
Because we were on the Motor Speedway, and he had all these cars, one of which was a 1910 45-horsepower Model H Lozier called Briarcliff.
That's a familiar word for Atlantans. Okay.
Yeah, so the name Briarcliff, we get Briarcliff Estate. He named his yacht Briarcliff. He named everything Briarcliff, and it all came from this car that he had. And he raced his cars. He hired racers to race his cars. He hired pilots to race his airplanes. But in 1909, he and his friends buy land near Hapeville, south of Atlanta, to build this huge racetrack, and later promote a race there in 1909. This was supposed to be the biggest race, the best race ever. He got famous drivers at the time to come to the race, but it turned into big trouble.
Trouble, how so?
Well, there were wrecks for sure.
Yeah.
Nice big fiery wrecks. But the races themselves were a success, but the bigger problem was more of the business aspect of it and the financial aspect of it. There was a falling out among the business partners in this Speedway venture over petty, petty stuff. And this produced a lot of bad press for Buddy. His name was dragged through the mud, and there was a lot of debt left over. So with no big race to follow, the Speedway was foreclosed upon. It became Candler Airfield, which then became Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport.
And so was he into airplanes at that point as well, or?
Yeah, whatever was new, he came along.
Okay. He was one of the, he was a gadget guy back in the day.
He would have been a tech bro right now. So he had his personal pilot who would race his planes, but the sort of turning point came in 1916 when the Candler children inherit Coca-Cola, and the kids cash out. They become mega, mega rich, spreading their money around. And a few years later, Buddy approaches Alderman William Hartsfield in Atlanta about leasing and eventually buying Candler Field in terms favorable to the city, and that becomes ATL.
So that was a flop that turned into something good, but I imagine he might have had some flops that were just flops, right?
A lot of failures, like I said. It's hard to imagine anyone but a son of the founder of Coca-Cola failing so much and still getting people to believe in his wild ideas. And one of my favorite stories is the floating school.
This audacious idea of buying a transport ship, naming it after himself, and launching a prep school for boys to sail around the world. He actually got a lot of wealthy men in the Atlanta area on board with it, Cater Wolford being probably the most well-known name of he of course, started the company that eventually became Equifax. None of his family invested, I think, is notable. He spent $250,000 of 1924 money to buy a U.S. Army transport ship, immediately renamed it the SS Candler, and sailed it over to Charleston to be refitted to become a school.
But eventually didn't pan out financially.
I would say shorter span than even eventually. Very quickly, it didn't pan out. The financial model just didn't make sense. He advertised the tuition and the enrollment, and if you do the math, there's no way this thing was ever going to turn a profit. So within a year, maybe a year and a half, that he had that thing very quietly melted down for scrap.
Would you want to attend a prep school on a ship that goes around the world?
I mean, I don't want to attend anything on boats. I've heard enough about plague barges and whatnot that I just don't want to get on them. So I just, but yeah, but it, I mean, there are worse things that you could do on a boat than go to school.
It sounded like fun for the rich. Well, another favorite story of mine was the Fox Theater. And I don't know how much you know about the Fox Theater.
I know close to nothing. So.
Well, if you don't know anything, check out GPB's very own special that we produced on the Fox Theater called The Fabulous Fox. You can watch it on YouTube, actually.
But Candler had a role in creating it, or?
Well, yeah. The theater started out in 1928 as a headquarters for the Shriners, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's how it gets all that, like, Egyptian mosque, Middle Eastern theme.
Okay.
It was supposed to be this grand, grand thing.
He headed up the financial planning committee. So he's the one that laid out all of the financial planning of how they were going to build it. It's one of the reasons that it was such a big plan, which is one of the reasons why ultimately the organization couldn't afford to finish it. He was directly involved, but he rallied people and raised a lot of money that ultimately still wasn't enough to complete the project.
So it was sort of a flop because it didn't turn out to be a Shriners thing. But it actually turned into something good. You know, this is his whole life story. He wants everything to be the biggest, the best. He's this wild promoter. He couldn't have any venture or hobby without some kind of superlative and all these tall tales about what this new venture is going to be. Even his farm was going to be the state-of-the-art farm with cow drinking fountains, you know, automated cow drinking fountains. And he got into magic, too, this. You know, we can go on and on about all these hobbies, but he got into magic, and he claimed to have gotten tricks from Harry Houdini.
Huh. So, just to be clear, he's a guy who inherited a lot of money and is obsessed with having the biggest, the best, the largest crowds ever, perhaps?
Yeah. yes.
That sounds somewhat familiar, though I can't quite place it.
Well, the way the AJC put it was that he was a blowhard and a wastrel. And I don't know where they found those two words, but I like them. He was a liar and he was a failure, but people were just drawn to him.
I think a lot of it had to do with him being a very charismatic person, just reported from friends and family. He was just very likable. And I think he had a way of getting people excited and getting on board. I do want to say that, yes, his legacy is marked by a lot of failure, but Atlanta's skyline is kind of shaped by his failure. There are a lot of institutions that we wouldn't have if he hadn't swung big and failed. In the long run, we still have a lot of his ideas. We wouldn't have the airport. We wouldn't have the famous Claremont Hotel without him.
Okay, Claremont Hotel. Not the Claremont Lounge, which Google if you're not at work, but Claremont Hotel in particular.
Well, it's one building. It started out as an apartment building in 1924, owned or managed by Buddy's real estate company. That later became a hotel and lounge. And, you know, I'll decline from talking further about Claremont Hotel and Lounge.
Okay.
For fear of talking about infamous strippers or something.
There you go. Okay. Well, you mentioned that he had hobbies, magic. We need to talk about this magic. So he liked to say he was taught by Harry Houdini. Is that what you said?
No. His company had an office in New York in which Harry Houdini was a tenant. And he quite possibly could have met Harry Houdini.
Okay, bumped into him in the hallway and suddenly knows magic.
So there's no doubt that, you know, he met Harry Houdini at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But these tales of, oh, Harry Houdini taught me this, you know, his last trick, you know, it's crazy. But he had interest in baseball, pipe organs, exotic animals. He went on African safaris. You know, he's, again, this very bored rich man of the Great Gatsby era with a top hat and cigar. And what I like about Butler's treatment is that she goes into detail, meticulous research. I didn't tell you, but this is the first ever biography of Asa Candler Jr.
Huh.
And so there was a lot of living descendants. There's a lot of family lore out there, stories handed down from one person to another. But
there was family lore, but a lot of what I was trying to unpack was what Atlanta remembers of him. So there were all of these rumors out there about how, you know, Buddy's ghost haunts his mansion and he would get drunk and glare at people and, you know, he buried elephants all over Druid Hills. Well, none of that was true. And so teasing apart what was myth versus reality was the main driver of this project. Originally, this wasn't going to be a book. All I wanted to do was know what was true.
Is it not true, or did we just not find the elephants? They're still out there.
Yeah. Do some ground-penetrating radar in Druid Hills.
So, all right. So I know you were a tour guide in Savannah for many years, and a lot of what you're telling me, you know, the elephants, the Claremont Hotel stuff, sounds like tour guide kind of stories. What do you make of her storytelling? Is it sort of in the genre of tour guide stuff?
I think she's amazing because she debunks myths. You know, back in Savannah, I took great pleasure in debunking myths that were repeated over and over.
Oh, what a killjoy of a tour guide. You got to just elaborate on the myths and build them up.
Well, she starts with facts. And when there's no evidence, she says there's no evidence. She gives an interpretation. She makes sure that everybody knows it's an interpretation. She offers alternative explanations. And she does this all in a very conversational style. It's fast moving. She's got these repeating themes that come up that I enjoy. And all the way to the end, there's a new chapter. There's something new, but always sort of repeating.
So ultimately, I should say, that's what you want a biography to do, not the crazy tour guide stuff I just mentioned. But what, in your opinion, gives this book the narrative edge?
Well, all that stuff that I was just talking about, the great conversation, the storytelling, the facts. It's the way she tells the story and the story itself. I sort of got interested in it. I picked up the book because I had been on Cumberland Island. Mm. I know I'd been on the coast for many years, and I'd been to Cumberland Island, and the Candler family had property out there, which I had visited. Now, this was another branch of the Candler family. Buddy had never been to Cumberland Island, but that's how it got me interested in this story. But, you know, there's all of these other eccentric millionaires that we hear stories about. Howard Hughes, let's name some more. Hmm. Richard Branson, Leona Helmsley, Elon Musk, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous with Robin Leach, you know. We all want to stare at this lifestyle, even though they're crazy, they're lunatics, but, you know, we're just sort of drawn to them.
I wanted to ask about the parenting that he received when he was a kid. What was it like? Was he just completely indulged or ignored? It seems like his whims were just allowed to develop where they would.
Well, yeah, he had the support of his rich father, who gave him plum positions within the company. The companies, I should say. It wasn't just Coca-Cola, but there was like a cotton mill and other things. But as far as the childhood is concerned, Butler really goes into the difference between the two brothers, Howard and Asa Jr., a.k.a. Buddy, with the father always, you know, sort of making excuses for him. But Howard was more of the straight and narrow one.
Hmm.
He was always trying to, maybe I get the impression that he was always kind of trying to live up to the father and not really getting there.
Well, fascinating story. The book is called Fortune and Folly, The Weird and Wonderful Life of an Eccentric Millionaire by Sarah Butler. Orlando, thanks for telling me about it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB News podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.
As you've learned here on Narrative Edge, Georgia's influence on the literary world is far-reaching. And the same can be said for the Peach State's influence on the agricultural world. For instance, did you know that more than 50% of all peanuts grown in the U.S. are grown right here in Georgia? Or that some of the finest cotton sheets on the planet are made by Georgia cotton farmers? Join me, David Zelsky, on the Fork in the Road podcast, and I'll introduce you to the farmers, chefs, artisans, makers, and bakers who all help power Georgia's agricultural economy. Find a Fork in the Road wherever you get your podcasts.